Is to order, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2124. Sandy.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2124 is directing state agencies that provide services to children and their families to develop a statewide plan based on local coordinated comprehensive plans. It's directing the state agencies to jointly submit a budget and legislative recommendations based on the local plans. What we have, you have the Dash 1 amendments. Well, we first had a public hearing on this bill on February 17th. At that point, there were some suggestions for some amendments. We do have those amendments. They're the Dash 1s. You have a hand-engrossed version of that. You also have attached, provided by former Representative Janet Carlson, just a brief overview of the current budget process of how the local communities work with the agencies in developing their budgets. So this is reference material for you. The amendments are directing the state agencies to consult and include the local agencies and or representative during the budget preparation process, and it is establishing an effective date for the 2005-2007 biennium. This does have a prior reference to Ways and Means.
Any questions? I'll give you a moment. If there are no questions, the chair would entertain a motion to adopt the Dash 1. Is everybody awake today?
No.
Okay.
I'll move it in.
Representative Mona Sanderson moves the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2124. Are there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, are we going to be hearing from any of the state agencies regarding the Dash 1 amendment?
Is anybody out there?
Commissioner Children and Families.
You guys want to read this soon? Let it go.
I think they're asleep too.
You want to hear from them?
Yeah.
Okay. Front and center. Way to start a week. And
good morning.
Good morning.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Donna Middleton. I'm the director of the State Commission on Children and Families. Just a couple comments on the Dash 1 amendments around local partners participating in the budget development for programs that support children and families at the local level. We have a mechanism, at least for the State Commission, in which we do work and have worked very closely with local folks around doing and developing budgets for the State Commission on Children and Families. The only time we don't do that is when there are immediate reductions that need to be taken and we have to make some very difficult and quick decisions around reductions. However, I will say at this particular time, we have a working group of local commissions in the State Commission working on our current 03-05 budget. So I will say to you that we have a fairly close working relationship. Now, this also talks about the relationship with the local public health officials and the other agencies that deliver mental health services and alcohol and drug services. That's a Department of Human Services relationship, and I'm not here at this particular time to speak for their working relationship on budgetary issues. Though Community Comprehensive Plan does require that all state agencies that are part of the plan use the plan as a way to develop their budgets.
We have a question. Thank you. I've been involved with the working group regarding the budget for this commission, for both the state's commission and the local commission. How does this bill and the Dash 1 amendments affect the budget?
Chair Cruz, Representative Tomei, it affects the budget in that it actually models the working relationship that you have observed recently, where they would, at the table, sit down and both try to come to some agreement on whatever budget was there for local commissions and the state commission.
So, if I may follow up, so this does not negatively affect the commission's budget nor the local commission's budget? Is that what I'm hearing?
Representative Tomei, it doesn't negatively affect it. However, it does require a longer process and some additional support at the state level. So we do have a fiscal impact on this particular piece of legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Which is why it's going to Ways and Means.
Okay.
To be part of that decision matrix down there. The real impact potentially would be the budget in the next biennium, which is what the planning would be for.
Right.
So, but it would be part of the front end decision process. Hopefully, that would go into the governor's recommended budget.
When you say next biennium, you're talking about 2003-2005.
No, I'm talking about 2005-2007. Yes.
Okay, I didn't understand that. I see. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. The chair would entertain a motion on the bill.
So moved.
Representative Anderson moves House Bill 2124 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
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 Excused? Aye. House Bill 2124, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2124. Open a work session on House Bill 2126. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2126, we've had a couple of public hearings on it. We have it back in front of us with a dash one and dash two. This is directing the State Commission on Children and Families and the local commissions to lead a joint effort to coordinate and increase access to the family support services. Primarily, a lot of the focus is on the parenting program. It is declaring an emergency, but that is being removed. I apologize. I didn't take that off. The dash one amendments specify that the any funding appropriation is based on the availability of funds, and the dash two amendment is removing the Head Start program. And we have a couple of conceptual amendments. One is on line 29, page 4. I think you have a partially hand-engrossed attachment. Conceptually, to also minimize the fiscal impact of this bill, remove beginning at funded with state alcohol and drug language on line 29, continuing on to line 30, delete abuse funds. So that would be removed, and then remove the emergency clause on page 5, lines 9 through 11, replacing it with an effective date of July 1, 2005. Which would then also change the reporting mechanism up on line 7. Currently, it's written February 1, 2005, and we would make that February 1, 2007.
Any questions? It still has a subsequent referral.
Yes.
Even though we've removed most of the funding from it.
It doesn't. It was conceptual. It's part of this because we can't
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you. I will be voting no on this, primarily because, you know, ultimate goal would really, it would be nice to have cost-based budgeting or whatever the term is, and this is something in our environment in which I can't support just because of not wanting to add more to the local commissions, so I will be voting no.
Yeah. Any other discussion? I want to speak a little bit to the Dash 2 amendment. One of the concerns that was expressed was the inclusion of Head Start, and the Dash 2 removes Head Start. So, we have tried in this with the full understanding that we need to have somebody who is a lead agency in the coordination as we try to move towards wraparound services. We did not want to step on toes inappropriately. Head Start folks said they're already doing that and did not want to be specifically included, and so we were willing to exclude them for that purpose. The Dash 1 basically makes it, it does not require any funding to go there because it makes it subject to availability, and so that becomes a decision matrix in Ways and Means once again. So we're not mandating any funding going anywhere here. It's more the policy of this, and which is also the reason for the removal of the emergency clause and the inclusion of an effective date, so that also is out into the next biennium and becomes part of the decision process leading up to that. So that's basically the purpose of the amendments. Questions? Representative Dalto, you have a question?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Are we ready for a motion?
We are ready. We will need actually three motions. One to adopt the Dash 1s, one to adopt the Dash 2s, and then we will. So let's do those two first.
I move
the Dash 1s. Representative Barker moves the adoption of the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2126. Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
I move we adopt Dash 2.
Representative Barker moves the adoption of the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2126. Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Okay, now what we need, if we are going to conceptually amend, and does everybody understand the conceptual amendments here at this point? We would need to suspend the rules for the purpose of conceptually amending. So Representative Barker moves for suspension of the rules. Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
I move we accept the conceptual amendments.
Okay. Representative Barker moves the conceptual amendments to House Bill 2126, which would be to eliminate on page 4, line 29 and 30, the words funded with state alcohol and drug abuse funds, and also on page 5 to eliminate section 7, which is lines 9 through 11, and replace that with this act takes effect July 1st, 2005, and would also on page 7 line or page 5, line 7, excuse me, change the date to 2000, from 2005 to 2007. Okay. Representative Anderson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, does that also on line 28 of page 4 remove including Head Start program?
No, that was the Dash 2 amendment. The Dash 2 amendment eliminated.
You're right. Didn't see
you. Okay. Okay, does everybody clear on the conceptual amendment? Okay. Are there any objections? Seeing none, the conceptual amendment is adopted. And Representative Barker moves.
Yeah, I move House Bill 2126, the Ways and Means of the New Pass, with the amendments.
Okay. Representative Barker moves House Bill 2126, as amended and conceptually amended, to the Committee on Ways and Means with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I share Representative Monis Anderson's concerns, and I will be voting no on this.
Okay. Yeah, I will. Any other discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The other thing is by changing this to the budget July 1st, 2005, I would think we would be better equipped in the next special session. Oh, no.
What the hell are you talking about?
The next session in 2005 to deal with this, rather than here we're passing out a bill here that says, well, we don't have the money now, but we'll have it in 2005, and there's no guarantee that we will. And so that's another reason to vote.
Well, it doesn't say we will have the money. It says when we have the money, and that would, you know, assuming that the economy is recovering, that would be a decision matrix that would need to be happening before the legislature convenes to have any impact. So, any other discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
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 No.
No.
Excused. Aye. House Bill 2126, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2126 and open a work session on House Bill 2240. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2240 is establishing the Oregon Board of Dentistry account in the state treasury. It modifies the conditions under which the Oregon Board of Dentistry may refuse to issue or renew licenses, modifies the procedures relating to the applicant's failing licensing exams, and it limits durations of proceedings or investigation of applicants, licensees, and former licensees. As you may recall, back in February when we had a public hearing, there was quite a bit of discussion about supervision of the dental hygienists and dental assistants. Parties went off and came back with some suggested language, which are the dash ones, which basically are keeping the current statute as is, where we are including under the supervision of a dentist in the indicated areas. The dash two amendments add an emergency clause to the dash one amendments. And so the dash twos are incorporated if that's the direction the committee chooses to go. And I believe you've gotten some testimony from different individuals regarding the dash ones.
Questions? Comments? Representative Anderson.
Process-wise, you want the dash twos and dash one. Dash two includes dash one.
Correct.
Yes.
So it would be movement of that prior to discussion?
Well, if that's the committee's pleasure to, you know.
Well, I thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to see us go ahead and move the dash two, because I think it really it does keep in place the strength of the scope of practice within the Dental Practice Act. And while it may have some minor changes regarding some of the nursing homes, if I understand it correctly, the board can rewrite any rules to allow the practice of assistance under hygienists in those situations. But I think we definitely need to keep the activity of the dental hygienist under the scope, under the authority of the dentist. And so I would move the dash two first.
Representative Anderson moves the dash two amendment to House Bill 2240. Discussion. Yes. Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Ms. Chair Cruz. Is it possible to get the board up here to just clarify that concept of having this be done by rule?
Yes, it is, as a matter of fact. Amazingly so.
Good morning. I'm Joanne Bones, Executive Director for the Board of Dentistry. The question from Representative Mona Sanderson is, I understand, can the board do this by rule? The board certainly has the authority to adopt rules regarding dental assistance. I'm not positive that without a change in the statute that says that a dental hygienist may be delegated the authority to supervise some duties of a dental assistant, that we could actually extend that. We certainly do in the general dental office. We do know and were advised by our previous assistant attorney general that we needed to include the authority for a limited access permit dental hygienist to supervise a dental assistant in limited access settings. We needed to do that in statute. Therefore, the board's bill was submitted, as you see it, in House Bill 2240, and the board does not support the Dash 1 amendments.
To follow up then, so I understand, I think you were clear when you said that for sure you couldn't by rule affect this in a dental office, but in the limited access organizations or agencies, you said you could or you couldn't. I didn't.
Chair Cruz, Representative Mona Sanderson. It's my understanding from recommendations from the Attorney General's office that we need the statutory change in order for the limited access hygienist to employ a dental assistant. And may I follow up, Chair? The issue of the supervision of dental hygienists in the dental office is actually dealt with in the dental hygiene statute, ORS 680, where it says that a dentist may employ dental hygienists to work in the dental office under the general supervision of a dentist. The request that we're asking for in the definitions under 679 takes away the conflict that exists between that definition and the unsupervised practice of limited access dental hygienists.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you please tell us the relationship between the Board of Dentistry and the Oregon Dental Association?
Chair Cruz, Representative Tomei, the Board of Dentistry is established in statute to regulate the practice of dentistry and dental hygiene and is made up of appointed board members, both dentists and dental hygienists, and a public member. The Oregon Dental Association is a professional association of dentists that represents to the legislature and the American Dental Association and whoever the interests of dentistry in their business practices and of course lobby, you know, for their perspectives in the practice of dentistry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's confusing to me why there would be this misunderstanding or disagreement among these two groups. Can you talk some about that? Am I putting you in a very difficult position?
Yes, ma'am. Chair Cruz, Representative Tomei.
Joanne, I don't think you have to answer that. You stated the board's opinion, and I don't think it would be appropriate for you to assume somebody else's opinion here.
I did not intend to assume somebody else's position. And by and large, I believe we have excellent working relationships on this particular issue. The two organizations happen to disagree.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
I guess I could speak to that a little bit. The Dental Association, the ODA, has over the last 5-6 years been like a willow in the breeze, kind of bending and bending and bending and giving more rights and more scope of practice to the Dental Hygiene Association. And I think they feel that ultimately it's certainly in the dental practice, it is the liability that falls on the shoulders of the doctor for the dental hygienist and the dental assistant. And they feel that they've given quite a bit in allowing and in encouraging, actually, a limited practice hygienist. And they just feel that there's a point at which the quality of the practice of dentistry really needs to be retained within the dental practice, within the doctor's authority. And I think the subtraction of dental hygienist on line 9 and the addition of under the supervision of a dentist are a reaction of the dental the doctors saying this is certainly adequate. We can do a very quality practice if those -2 amendments are added. And it just kind of tightens up the liability and the chain of authority within the dental office.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My main concern is access for patients. And let's take my mother, for example, who is basically bedridden and needs really daily care, mouth care, but she doesn't need a dentist. And fortunately, my niece is a dental assistant and another niece is the dental hygienist, so we really don't have that issue, so we can do it on a volunteer basis with family. But those are the types of situations that I have most concern about, are people who are, say, in a residential long-term care facility who really do need care of the mouth. And when you're a bedridden and you're in a bed, and your mouth needs to have proper hygiene or else you're going to be losing your teeth probably within 6 months to a year, someone told me anyway, in the elderly in particular. And so that's the situation I'm thinking about, and that's why I would be opposed to the amendment, because I'm most concerned about those people who really need to have care but don't have that dentist there on site.
Mr. Chair, and that certainly can be handled by the dental hygienist. Given the authority by the doctor, we're talking about the second stage down, as I understand it, that we're delegating to the hygienist and then delegating again, and we're just trying to say, no, it's the doctor that should have the authority over the dental assistant helping the dental hygienist in that situation. That situation can continue as before. If I'm is that correct? That the hygienist can go into the nursing home, do the work, under the delegation of authority from the doctor, or as a limited access, she can do it on her own.
Representative Cruz, Representative Anderson, you're correct to that extent. What the board is trying to get to is allowing the dental hygienist who works in the limited access settings to employ the services of the dental assistant to assist with those dental hygiene functions. The second piece of that is allowing the dentist to delegate through the dental hygienist some amount of supervision by the dental hygienist for a dental assistant when the dentist is not in the office, purely for dental hygiene functions that the dental hygienist is already authorized to do. She wouldn't be allowing an assistant to do anything out of their scope of practice. It's just a matter of making it easier, and it would still be at the discretion of the supervising dentist.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
And I appreciate that there are relatively few instances there compared to the scope within the dental office where the hygienist may be working without the doctor there and employing a dental assistant. And what I'm getting at is that the more you allow accessory help, dental assisting, to speed up the practice of the hygienist and increase the volume of work, the less the scope, the less the quality of care, or should I say, the quality of care is lessened. So we're just trying to assure that the dental hygienists can certainly operate, but we don't want to have more and more and more dental assisting speeding up that care and lessening the quality of care.
May I continue this with Representative Anderson? Thank you. But a dentist would have to okay that.
Not in the office.
Sure.
He could, but who knows when you're not there.
But why would he hire somebody who would be going beyond what
that's,
he or
that's
she...
That's why we're doing this, to try and keep that from occurring.
There has to be a dentist in the office, even if he or she is not there. There has to be.
There has to be a dentist originally, right?
Right.
But if he's out of the office, that's what we're talking about.
But why would he or she hire someone who would go beyond what he or she had wanted them to do?
Things don't work perfectly every time. You may hire somebody that may do things that you don't approve of.
Then why wouldn't you get rid of them?
Then you would. But why would you test that, is what I'm saying.
Hmm. Representative Dalton, do you have something?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a general question. Are dental hygienists able to operate independently? In other words, do they have their own, if they're not the limited access practitioners, they have their own standalone shops?
Chair Cruz, Representative Dalton, the answer is no.
Limited access, I think.
Okay. What does that mean, limited access? What does that mean, limited access?
Chair Cruz, Representative Tomei, limited access is defined in the statute as particular venues in which the dental hygienist who has the advanced permit can practice. They're basically nursing homes, homes that are licensed by the mental health division, whatever the agency is called now, school settings, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that gets school.
School settings. Sites such as Job Corps and I'm missing some, jails.
Okay, if I could follow up on that.
Yes.
So what might they do in that setting? What might the assistant, dental assistant do under the supervision of the dental hygienist?
Chair Cruz, Representative Tomei, it's my understanding that what the assistant would do would pretty much stand by hand instruments, help with the sterilization of instruments, very basic duties where it takes more than two hands to be providing the service to some of these very fragile and patients who are unable to really help themselves. And I am envisioning nursing home patients. My father-in-law was 104 years old in a nursing home when he passed away and was not able to cooperate with his care. And an assistant would be able to help a hygienist in those circumstances, probably do some minor prophylaxis and cleaning without extending the scope of their practice. It's just a hands-on, another set of hands.
So tell me, please, then, if this bill passes, what effect that will have on those processes? And if it doesn't pass, what effect it would have?
Chair Cruz, Representative Tomei, I understand your question to be if the bill passes without the amendments, the board would not be able to allow dental assistants to assist limited access dental hygienists in limited access settings.
No, that's with the amendments.
Without
the amendments.
Without the amendments. No, with the amendments. I'm confused. With the amendments.
Okay, could someone clearly... I thought it was following pretty good here until that little exchange, and
I appreciate
the confusion. Could you tell us what the implications are if the bill passes with the amendments and without the amendments?
Get my head together here. Chair Cruz, Representative Westland. If the bill passes as submitted by the board, limited access dental hygienists would be able to hire a dental assistant to help them in providing dental hygiene services in nursing homes, mental health residential facilities, school settings, jails. In addition, which is part of the controversy, a dentist in a general dental office would have the option of allowing a dental assistant to provide assisting services to a dental hygienist providing dental hygiene services when the dentist is not in the office.
That's the original bill.
That's the original bill.
Okay, so they could get into nursing homes, mental health facilities.
Right.
Okay. If the bill passes with the amendments, what's the implications for those populations?
Those things that I talked about would not be allowed by statute.
Without prior authorization of a dentist.
Chair Cruz, Representative Westland, they would not be legal under the Dental Practice Act.
Even with
prior authorization from a dentist.
Representative Cruz, Representative Westland, with all due respect, sometimes dentists authorize things that are not allowed within the Dental Practice Act, so I'm talking about the law versus what happens in the community. What the board is trying to do is make some things that happen within the general community actually legal within the Dental Practice Act.
Well, it's nice to be legal whenever it's convenient.
It's all about patient care and access.
Representative Dalto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so my question is, as the original bill is written, in a limited access permit, could a dental hygienist hire a dental assistant if that dental hygienist had a contract to serve a nursing home?
Representative Cruz, Representative Dalto, the answer is no. That's what we're trying to do.
Even if they were working independently?
A limited access permit, dental hygienist by definition works without supervision of a dentist, is an independent contractor per se, and is not allowed to hire a dental assistant because the definition of dental assistant in the statute as it stands today is that a dental assistant works under the supervision of a dentist.
So who cleans their instruments?
They do their own.
They do
it themselves.
Any other questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, I still just want to make sure I'm understanding this correctly, because I think this is an important part of the care compendium in this state. So, as written, they can't, dental hygienists cannot.
Current law.
Current law, right. as this bill is drafted, current law, dental hygienists cannot get into nursing homes, mental care facilities, whatever.
Current law. That's what the bill's addressing.
Oh, okay. Then, if House Bill 2240 passes as written, hygienists would be allowed into nursing homes, mental health facilities, whatever, to provide dental care to bedridden or immobile populations. Yes or no?
It's the assistant.
It's the assistant.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe, and help me. This is the relationship between the hygienist and the dental assistant.
Right.
They want the hygienist in the already specified arenas where they can work to have assistants help them. That's what this bill is doing. Without the amendment. With the amendment, it's just keeping the status quo that an assistant, dental assistant, can only work directly under the supervision of a dentist. In other words, they cannot go into these off-site type settings unless the dentist went with them or whatever, which then would complicate the limited access permit structure that they have. Was that clarifying?
That helps. I mean, I guess I'd say Jane tried to talk to me, Paul tried to talk to me. I wish I'd listened more carefully to what they were trying to tell me.
They're here if you'd like them to come up.
Yeah, I follow,
Mr.
Chair.
Representative, are you okay
yeah,
in the moment? Well, you're not okay, but you're you.
Yeah. And define moment. You know,
yeah. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 2, number 9, when it talks about general supervision. So even in a situation, as we've been discussing, in a nursing home, that the general supervision is going to be have to be under a dentist. Is that correct?
Representative Cruz, Representative Tomei, I'm sorry, I don't know where you are on this.
Oh.
What's page 9?
Page 2, number 9.
Page 2 of House Bill 2240?
Correct. 917?
Chair Cruz, Representative Tomei, that's the definition of general supervision, which applies in certain circumstances defined within the statute where a dental hygienist working in a general office works under the general supervision of a dentist, which means that the dentist authorized the procedure but doesn't have to be on site when the procedures are performed. A limited access dental hygienist who works in nursing homes, for instance, does not work under a dentist at all, and no supervision is involved.
Got it. Great. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the impression has been given that the hygienist really can't go into a nursing home and work unless they have a dental assistant. That's certainly not true. You can take a pack of sterilized instruments or 20 packs, go in and work on 20 patients, take your instruments, go back to the office, and do all the work that needs to be done. Four-handed dentistry really relates to four-handed dentistry, not to dental hygiene. You don't, you know, I've done plenty of root planing and scaling of patients' teeth, which is the domain of the dental hygienist. And it might be nice to have a dental assistant, but it's certainly not required. I think the impression that you have to have somebody with you at all times is not necessary.
I guess my question on that would be, for example, you're in a nursing home, you don't have a dentist chair, and you have somebody who may be not the most cooperative person in the world, and you have to manage the patient, you know, maybe just spitballing, somebody to hold the head stationary, things like that while you do the work, because you don't want somebody thrashing around when you got a sharp instrument in their mouth. So I guess that's the sort of thing I'm thinking that this is supposed to be addressing.
So, would there not be personnel from the nursing home for that?
I'm not sure they could assist.
That'd be better.
Representative Barker.
Mr. Chair, on that line of reasoning, is a dental assistant qualified to manage somebody in a residential care community? I mean, if they were thrashing around and stuff, you probably want somebody that's experienced with that old residential population, I think, to manage them.
Well, maybe I guess I'm wondering what sort of training is required to hold somebody's head still. But, you know, I haven't been trained, but I think I can hold your head still, Representative. Okay. Representative Barker.
I was just going to say the same concern, Mr. Chair, that in a nursing home setting, it would seem like it'd be better to have a dental assistant with the hygienist out there. You know, in an office, I certainly think the doctors would be in charge, but when they're in a mental home or in the jail, It would be more efficient and probably a little safer for everybody, including the patient. And I mean, of course, I'm not a dentist, but I don't see this as an invasion into the authority of the doctors and their practice. A dental assistant in with a hygienist into the nursing home. And I have the same thing. I have a very elderly mother that's in nursing care, and I don't know how cooperative or not cooperative she might be. But.
Any other discussion? There's a motion on the table to adopt the Dash 2 amendments. Is there any objection to the Dash 2s?
Yes.
Okay. Clerk, call the roll.
Representative
Anderson?
Aye.
Representative
Barker?
No.
Representative
Dalton?
Aye.
Representative
Monahan?
No.
Representative Tomei?
I guess I've got to ask a question.
Dash 2 does is add emergency class.
No. Dash 2.
That's what it says here. That's different.
No, Dash 2 is the Dash 1s with an emergency clause added to it.
Dash 2 is Dash 1 with emergency clause. Thank
right.
you. No.
Representative
Weissman. Aye. Chair votes no. The Dash 2 amendments, having not received the required majority, are declared failed. Committee, I would like the committee will stand at ease for a moment. Committee, I do intend on moving this bill, or I would like to, because Senator Fischer wants it, and I try to be cooperative with the man who used to be my senator before redistricting. But we have two options here. We could conceptually amend the Dash 2s to include only the emergency clause in the bill, or we could say let it go as it is and let them add that on the Senate side. So do you want to do it cleaner and just move the bill as it is and have the Senate put the emergency clause on?
Okay.
Then the chair would entertain a motion on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2240 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2240 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative
Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Dalton.
Aye.
Representative
Monahan. Aye.
Representative
Weissman.
Aye.
Do we want a consent calendar? Or not? No? Too much? Okay. House Bill 2240, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Who wants to carry? Representative Mona Sanderson will carry. I will have questions. Okay. And close the work session on House Bill 2240 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2018. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2018 is brought forward at the request of Chiropractic Association of Oregon. And Dr. Vern Sable is here to give us some background on that information. It's prohibiting insurers offering motor vehicle liability policies from entering into or renewing any contracts that provide or has the effect of providing managed care services to beneficiaries.
Questions if you want to ask them. Okay, Vern, and whoever you want to bring with you, we have three chairs, we can use them all. Please, go ahead.
Hi, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Dr. Vern Sabo. I'm from Albany. I am the current president of the Chiropractic Association of Oregon, of whom I represent today. House Bill 2018 is very straightforward and simple in its intent, and that intent is to not allow managed care to swallow up auto insurance. Currently in this country, the HMO and managed care schemes are not working effectively. Consumers wish to select the health care provider of their choice. If an Oregon consumer is injured in an auto accident, they're injured and they're scared, they want to see the health care provider of their choice. More specifically and more likely, they want to see a doctor who they've known and trusted for a number of years. They do not want to be told that they have to see an individual on a list of which they have no familiarity. They don't even know who these people are, nor their level of expertise. Also, under current U.S. law, an individual who is injured in an auto accident due to the negligence of another individual has the right to full physical restoration. Through the reasonable and necessary medical treatment and rehabilitation, they have the right to at least an attempt to be made whole once again. Managed care organizations, by their very nature, tend to limit medical benefits, limit medical treatment, and as a result are in conflict with that concept. Also, unlike other insurance, such as workers' compensation, where large employers and small employers, such as myself, pay the premiums, consumers pay these auto premiums. You and I pay these premiums, and we are mandated to have this insurance by the state. Consequently, consumers who have been injured must have the right to select the health care provider of their choice. Now, we're concerned about cost as well. The reasonableness and necessity of care is something that concerns the insurance companies, and we understand that, and concerns us as well, costs. However, currently, the methods by which the insurance companies are supposedly restricting costs, we feel are somewhat unscrupulous. They're using three mechanisms. One is an independent medical exam. The second is a paper review known as paper reviews, and the third is known our software programs. Now, the independent medical exams, this is a means by which when the insurance carriers dispute the medical benefits that have been utilized as being not reasonable and necessary, the auto carriers select examiners of their choice. These individuals are affectionately referred to as the insurance docs. There are more colorful descriptions and you as an auto as an injured consumer must go to these exams. These exams and the outcomes are very predictable are not in the best interest of the consumers. The second mechanism is known as paper reviews. This is where the insurance companies who are disputing your care as being reasonable and necessary send your medical records many times to a vendor who will do a review of the records, supposedly a medical provider, a physician is to look at those medical records and determine if the accident in question could have caused your injuries. Has the treatment that's been rendered, is it reasonable and necessary? And if time losses was appropriate, is continued treatment needed? Unfortunately, this has set up a couple of situations which have happened in the past, one of which was featured on NBC Dateline, where it was showed that State Farm Insurance Company was utilizing a company in San Diego known as CMR, Comprehensive Medical Reviews. Instead of a medical provider, a doctor reviewing these medical records, in fact, what was found was a nurse and a journalist were reviewing the records and utilizing pre-canned macros, merge files, and sentences, basically to write a report for the physician with that physician's medical opinion already written for the doctor before that doctor had stepped in the room and even looked at the medical records. We believe that's inappropriate. The most recent method is software programs in which they input the procedural codes and diagnostic codes, and the computer spits out a report with predictive outcomes. That is the center of a nationwide class action suit currently. We are concerned about costs. We don't believe the carrier should pay for anything other than reasonable and necessary care, and that is why we introduced a companion bill, Senate Bill 55, which would set up a truly independent and an unbiased review system through the insurance division when the carriers dispute treatment as being reasonable and necessary. This program is set up in the insurance division to truly give an unbiased and independent review. Interestingly, the insurance carriers have also lobbied against that. Our contention would be you can't have it both ways. So I have been working at the request of the Speaker's office on an amendment that would import some of that language. We can come to a conclusion and come up with some useful statutory language that will get consumers to the provider of their choice and also answer the question of reasonable and necessary care. I think, Mr. Chair, committee members, that concludes my testimony. I'd be willing to answer any questions if you have any.
I have a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do any auto insurers currently use a managed care system in Oregon?
Currently, no. Mr. Chair, Representative Westland, they have currently what are known as passive managed care panels.
So they don't use
they're not
managed care capitated system.
Well, they use what is known as a passive panel, wherein providers who have signed managed care contracts with general health insurance, and incidentally, the providers are being blindsided by these, have signed managed care contracts with general health insurance carriers. What has happened now is the auto insurance carriers have signed contracts many times without the provider's knowledge with these managed care organizations, and the only clue that the provider has is when they get their bills slashed by 20% and 30%. They must then in writing say that they don't want to be part of that program. So they have passive panels currently. We believe what the carriers would really like is to be able to offer a PPO option, we don't believe that would be in the best interest of consumers. I hope that answers your question.
Fair enough.
Any other questions? Representative Barker.
What kind of, if I'm paying the bills and I'm getting all these bills, I think this is ridiculous. This guy, I'm getting taken by an unscrupulous injured party. How? Where's the review there? Can't set him up for an IME.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, currently how the system works is the insurance carriers can mandate that the consumer go to a doctor of the insurance company's choosing, or they can use one of the IME vendors, both of which have predictive outcomes, generally against the consumer.
Any other questions? Go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Michael Freeman. I'm an epidemiologist and assistant professor at Oregon Health and Science University, School of Medicine, Department of Public Health and Preventive Medicine. My field is epidemiology of traumatic injuries, and my field of interest is motor vehicle crashes, and thus I was asked to come and speak to you today. I'll try not to say the word special session because I noticed that provoked a response.
We don't like that.
Yeah, I'll stay away from that. I just want to give a little bit of an overview of the magnitude of what this problem is. I think that for this kind of an issue, the purpose of this bill appears to me to be to proactively prevent managed care as a wolf in sheep's clothing from becoming restricted access to provider, rather than management of and cost containment of care. There are about 6 million injuries per year in the United States associated with motor vehicle crashes. It's the most frequent cause of injury and death associated with trauma in the United States, about 42,000 deaths per year. We have about 100 to 120,000 injuries per year in Oregon, and we have anywhere from 700 to 800 deaths per year. We manage to injure and kill ourselves most frequently in motor vehicles. The kind of injuries that get the most publicity are spinal cord injuries and brain injuries and other very severe injuries, but those constitute a very small fraction of the total amount of injuries that occur. The majority of injuries are spinal injuries, what are commonly known as whiplash. Whiplash is a pejorative term for some folks, but in the scientific world we use it to denote injuries that are to the spine, which can be anywhere from a simple sprain that gets better in a few days to disc herniation and other types of injuries that occur due to an inertial effect, a whipping type of effect, as opposed to a direct contact and fractures and that sort of thing. The kinds of folks that take care of these injuries, the kinds of providers, frequently are chiropractors, physical medicine physicians, orthopedic surgeons, and physical therapists, massage therapists. These are the folks that are most likely to be affected by managed care. It becomes much harder to get to these kinds of providers. For example, chiropractors are the least franchised state licensed provider group that's considered a physician in the managed care scheme in Oregon, and it's most difficult to get to these kind of providers if you are in a managed care panel, for example, in workers' compensation. In workers' compensation, pre-managed care utilization was about 18% of chiropractic. After managed care, it went down to 3%. The results and satisfaction with the kind of care that can be provided through a specialist or a chiropractor or a physical therapist has been shown repeatedly to be much, much higher than it is with family practice and internal medicine, who are the gatekeepers of managed care. These folks do a wonderful job of providing care for issues of organic illness, heart attack, hypertension, kidney failure. But when it comes to things like spinal injury and issues like pain, they show over and over in scientific study that they don't do as good of a job and that people don't do as well when they have this care. And as recently as 2 months ago, a paper came out in the Journal of American Medical Association, again talking about the fact that its primary care just doesn't do a really good job dealing with these kinds of injuries, and that there are other providers that do. So I think the primary purpose of this bill is to proactively prevent restriction of access to care, somewhat along the lines that Representative Mona Sanderson was talking about earlier, that access to care is very, very important, particularly for people who are essentially paying their own bills and paying their own way. Thank you.
Your questions, Representative Delto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Freeman, what did you mean when you said chiropractors were the least franchised group in that field? I didn't understand what you meant.
If you look at participation in managed care, chiropractors have a very, very low percentage of participation. Panels are typically closed very quickly to chiropractors. For example, in workers' compensation, a workers' compensation carrier that goes with a managed care organization is only required to have three providers in a particular geographic area where there may be 50 or 70 providers available. And therefore, there is a great deal of restriction to care. There are not good all-inclusive managed care panels at this point in time for groups like chiropractors.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Doctor.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is William Dallas, and I'm president of Western States Chiropractic College in Portland. I'm bringing another perspective in this testimony, and that is far more personal, which is not usual to a testimony that I offer. About a year ago, my wife, who is athletic, extremely healthy, had been having a difficult problem with heart arrhythmia. It was attributed to various causes, but the change being one of them, several others, and she'd been under care, been in the care of a cardiologist, had worn the heart monitor, and there had been an attempt to diagnose what the problem was, and it seemingly was getting worse. And finally, one week when I just happened to be out of town, she had a siege where the heart went into a series of arrhythmia, where she was becoming very lightheaded. She called the primary care office, which was covered under the policy which is offered by the college that I work with. She was told, if you're having chest pain, go to emergency. She said, but I'm not having chest pain. I've had this before. I've been under the care of a cardiologist. I need to see my cardiologist. The answer was, you cannot see your cardiologist until you come in to see us, and we cannot see you until next week. She accepted that on Saturday morning, which was 2 days later, 2.5 days later. She had an episode where she got up, went into the bath, and suddenly became very dizzy. She didn't know anything from then until the following week. She passed out, and the heart went into a major arrhythmia. She lost consciousness for 2 days, went to the hospital, and the circus began. Number one, she couldn't remember who her physician was because she had no short-term memory of any kind. They finally brought in a cardiologist who didn't happen to be the cardiologist who had been under her care, but nobody could identify because no one seemed to know who was in charge of this case. They finally sorted things out after that morning, and they determined what had happened, that she had a major heart, what amounted to kind of a sympathetic storm, lost enough blood supply to the brain where she lost all short-term memory, and then went through a long diagnostic process. To make a long story fairly short, it was finally determined after seven specialists were brought in. They managed to find, by going from the two major firms, the cardiology firms, as to who was her cardiologist, they began to apply the care, and then they finally diagnosed that she had a very unusual condition, which was able to be treated by what they called an ablation. There was a discrete group of cells in her heart that apparently is congenital. She was treated about 3 weeks later, and she's in perfect health today. Now, there are two post notes that I would like to make. Number one, the cardiologist who was responsible for her in the first place, he said, if anything like this happens again, you ignore the primary care provision. You call me directly, and we'll see that you get in immediately. Number two, the internist who she had been seeing for a number of years, because we had changed plans, was no longer eligible to see her. So the entire history of this patient was lost because of an attempt by a system to cut costs, no matter what the issue was. I'm happy to say today that she has a perfect heart, one of those rare outcomes. The electrocardiologist said this is the third case that he had ever seen, his wife being one of them. We had a great outcome, but her internist just 2 weeks ago gave her a physical. Finally, she was able to go back to her original internist because we changed plans again. And she said, do you know that over 90% of this type of case, when it occurs that early in the morning or in sleep, die? And so basically we felt that we were very fortunate. Now, what this amounts to is not medical incompetence. In fact, the medicine that was practiced was brilliant. The outcome was exceptional and certainly something remarkable. But the fact was that we almost lost someone who was in perfect health or should have been in perfect health because of a system that is absolutely flawed. My background is strong in insurance. I spent a number of years as CEO of a small property and casualty company that specialized in chiropractic malpractice. In that capacity, I was assigned by the state of Washington to a Senate Select Committee to work with the hospitals, with the medical profession, to, in 1985, determine what were some sound answers to the crisis that was developing in healthcare. And some of those solutions were the solutions that we are experiencing today. And let me assure you that even though they had some theoretical appeal at that time, we have a very seriously flawed system, and we have an awful lot of people that are being put at unnecessary risk. Now, if you want to compound that risk with the automatic, almost adversarial relationship between insurers and those who are filing claims under the personal injury protection provision of their insurance, you've got an even more complex problem. I would recommend that that this provision as being presented be passed to anticipate and to prevent further occurrences similar to that I've discussed. That's all I have to say, but if you have questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions? Representative Barker.
Kind of back, I don't know if anybody can answer. But it would seem to me that having an independent medical exam might be important if you were convinced somebody was cheating. And my experience with IMEs, I've served on a disability board. And if somebody's doc said something and our doc said something different, then the two docs would pick a third one to give the one would be the answer. And I didn't find that. Well, at least, I mean, of course, we weren't trying to. We were trying to take care of our people, so we didn't seek out doctors who would just say no, which I could see how that could happen. But wouldn't some system work that way, where you have an IME? If you didn't like it, then the two doctors pick a third doctor from a list of some that they could agree on. They could both pick one. So, I mean, it's something. I mean, I understand what you're trying to do. I think that's good, but I also don't want to not allow an insurance company to protect themselves from somebody who's trying to screw the system.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, exactly. We are, in fact, looking at it and working on an amendment that would make, clearly the insurance companies have to have the capacity to scrutinize treatment and determine whether it's reasonable and necessary, but we want that system to be unbiased. And that is the hope of the proposed statute in Senate Bill 55 that would have that system run through the insurance division, take it out of the private sector, and hopefully come up with an unbiased independent review.
Any other questions? Representative Westland.
Mr. Chair. I understand we're dealing primarily here with, as the good doctor from OHSU indicated, the major impact is auto accidents. And so my question is under current law, can an auto insurer impose managed care on a consumer who's currently receiving PIP benefits?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westland, no, they cannot.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If a consumer could get a lower priced auto insurance if they agreed to a managed care option, why shouldn't they have that option just like a consumer in health insurance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westland, the cost of personal injury protection, that portion of the insurance policy that would pays for all reasonable and necessary medical treatment if you're injured, constitutes 3-5% of the total cost of the policy. In another state, Colorado, that option was given. Interestingly, the carriers use what we believe is also a disingenuous marketing strategy, in that they told the consumers that you've been a wonderful policyholder for a number of years, but we want you to know that we have a new product, and that product is a PPO option. Now, if you only take that product in this new scenario, we can save you 40% on your auto insurance premiums. What they didn't tell the consumer is that percentage only applies to the PIP portion, which constitutes 2-3% of the total cost of the policy. So in that vein, they save a couple of dollars a month. Now, with that, it shuttles the patients into the injured consumers into a closed panel system in which you have PPO administrators. You have non-physicians who get to play doctor. When I say non-physicians who get to play doctor, what I mean is nurses and even claims reps who ride herd on the system and deny appropriate medical care, as well as special imaging, MRI, and the like, simply to reduce costs. And the clinical necessity becomes secondary. We don't believe that's in the best interest of Oregon consumers.
May I comment? Thank you. Representative Westland and Chair Cruz. I have some experience with the system in Colorado. I've had the opportunity to study what has happened in that area, both prior to and after the implementation of managed care. And what's happened is bureaucracy has reigned supreme there, and there has been tremendous problems with access to care. So the carrot, if you will, of reduced premiums came at the expense of access to care and to a provider of choice. And in fact, in that state, the providers who were most affected were the specialists and the chiropractors and the folks who were most likely to be utilized. And so there were there's essentially a cadre of docs who do most of the care and do it at the behest of the carriers there. And you're in and you're out quickly. And so there's a tremendous amount of private expense that goes on in Colorado for people who have been injured. And essentially it's cost shifting. It goes out of the PIP system and it goes into the private sector.
Mr. Chair, can I make a comment?
I understand and I empathize with what you're saying. And it's fairly common knowledge around this building that, you know, whatever we come up with, and this committee is intimately involved in that, you know, we're going to have to pull a very large rabbit out of a very small hat to prevent throwing 100,000+ people off the Oregon Health Plan. What is less widely known is that an equal number have already lost commercial health insurance benefits because the premium continues to rise. Now, there's a multitude of reasons for that. It's certainly not monocausational. But one of them is the additional cost mandates placed on the commercial carriers. And that's a huge cost shift, too. So I guess I just caution everyone, I mean, not only witnesses, but those in the audience, you know, that this state is facing a healthcare crisis. And one of the primary tools we have for managing that is whatever, you know, cost containment measures we can take. You talk about access. I understand. I empathize. And we just went through a dental bill here, you know, where most of what we were talking about was access. There is no access if the cost becomes too high, resulting in ultimately cost shift to those commercial policies that continue to rise in price. More people become uninsured from commercial plans, thereby, you know, not having any health insurance at all, or going to, quote, less reimbursement costs, public health insurance, you know, all of whom eventually present themselves to the hospitals, where it gets cost shifted again. And so I'm concerned about where we are and where we're going with this bill, Mr. Chair. It's a dilemma. It's difficult. You know, I don't disagree with the spirit of anything you gentlemen have said. That's all I've got to say. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a comment about Dr. Sable's comment about the Colorado example of going to a preferred provider option. Maybe you can clarify something for me, Dr. Sable. So I think your testimony was that in Colorado, some insurers offered a 40% discount on the premium if you would select a preferred provider option, which would put you into reduce your PIP coverage. Is that what you said?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dalto, what that system did was use a marketing strategy that if, in fact, a consumer would select the PPO option, they were telling consumers that they could save 40% on their auto insurance premiums, when in reality that percentage that they were throwing out there, and it's varying percentages, only applies to the PIP portion of the auto policy, which only constitutes 3 to 5% of the total cost of the policy. In fact, my wife and I just raised our PIP coverage benefits with the insurance company that we have, American Family, to, I believe it's $100,000. And the cost of doing that was, I believe, $5 or $8 a vehicle for 6 months. So if costs are such a factor, why does it cost so little to raise your our coverage from, I think it was $25,000 to $100,000?
Follow-up, Mr. Chair? So you're essentially making my point. So if my premium is $1,000, for example, just taking a round number, and I'm and an insurer is telling me they're going to save me 40%, I would expect that my premium would reduce by $400. And if it was only reduced by the 2 or 3% of the PIP portion of the general premium, I would see a reduction of $20 or $30 a year in an overall premium. So I'm asking you, why would a consumer be confused or be misled by an insurance company if they would be expecting a reduction that's commensurate with what was promised, $400 or whatever it would be?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Dalto, it's not the $400 they get. It's the 2 or 3% off of that. It's a matter of a few dollars. They clearly believe that 40% is going to come right off their monthly payment, and it does not.
Right, and so what I'm saying is it's easy for them to figure that out. When they change their insurance plan, would they drop that, or wouldn't the consumer be empowered to take action at that point?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dalton, I'm not clear on the statute at what point they could opt out of the PPO. Clearly, it's been said that if you were to survey any consumers in the local Safeway market, most of them couldn't tell you if they have a PPO option or if they have a standard policy.
But they'd be able to tell if they were saving $400 versus $30.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Representative Westland.
I'm sorry. Just a comment. I mean, I don't know if this is the gist of Representative Dalto's question or not, but, you know, they hear the advertising, save 40%, you know, fine. They go in, they're talking to their agent or whatever company's doing their marketing, their outreach for them. Isn't that going to consumer say, okay, I'm paying $1,000 now before they sign up? Agent goes, yep. Okay, what'll I be paying if I avail myself to your services? And the guy goes, you know, $920 or $950. Well, that's not 40%. Well, but it's 40% of this portion. I mean, part of this has got to be an informed consumer acting in his own enlightened self-interest. Colorado, that's fine. I know things happen in other states. I know things happen in Oregon, but I think it's a challenge to deal with Oregon's problems.
May I? Representative Westland and Mr. Chair, in Colorado that was handled by a lost leader strategy. Premiums were reduced by 30 or 40% initially, and then they were jacked up over the subsequent years. And so now there's pretty good parity between the one option and the other, and unfortunately you opt in the beginning of the year, you can't opt out till the end of the year, and there's all sorts of penalties and that sorts of things. Insurers are very good at figuring out how they're going to maintain their profits. I mean, that's what they're in the business to do, and rightfully so. That's not a problem. I think the purpose of this bill is to make sure that access isn't restricted under the auspices of controlling costs. Just to quickly address what you had mentioned before, you agree with us in principle. We agree with you in principle. Cost controls are incredibly important, and managed care is one way to control cost. But it also has a whole bunch of ills that go along with it. I think that a panel along the lines of what Representative Barker was talking about, like the disability panel, where, you know, they get to choose an arbiter. physician who can actually come in and give a less biased opinion. I think that's a great idea. Those kinds of ideas should need to be implemented also. I think we're concerned with a tide of managed care coming in and saying, okay, that's it, you're done, and you've got to go to these folks, and we know these folks are going to give us an outcome. And it's more proactive than anything else. It's certainly not to take away cost control from insurers, which is an extremely important part of doing business as an insurer in the state.
Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Powell and Sean Miller. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Powell. Before you, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. Mr. Chairman and members, rather than following point by point the testimony that's been given to you, let me simply say that advertising of an insurance product is regulated in Oregon. Any misrepresentation could lead to the losing of a license to do business in the state of Oregon. All rate filings are filed with the state of Oregon. They must be justified by the signature of an actuary. That shows that the benefit, the premium, will pay for the benefits offered in the policy. Let me simply state that under existing law, 7 ORS 742-524, all reasonable and necessary expenses of medical, hospital, dental, surgical, ambulance, and prosthetic services incurred within 1 year after the date of a person's injury must be paid for by an insurer. This law does not provide for managed care. In order to have a managed care system, this law would have to be totally rewritten. So the examples of that this may be about ready to happen, I think, are a little bit exaggerated. But let me end this testimony by simply stating that two things. First, in 2002, State Farm received 11,845 new PIP claims. They paid $25,545,000 in PIP Medical in 2002. Less than 2% of those claims, of the 11,000, less than 2% of those were reviewed for excess. In 2002, State Farm had one claim in a suit over PIP benefits and about five arbitrations over PIP in the entire year. The bill before you can be read very simply by going to page 2. The bill says on lines 31 and 32 that an insurer may not enter into or renew any contract that provides or has the effect of providing managed care services to beneficiaries. Well, if you read that in, and then add the definition of managed care from page 1, lines 8 through 10, it would read like this. An insurer may not enter into or renew a contract that provides or has the effect of providing arrangements that attempts to control or coordinate the use of health care services in order to contain health care expenditures or improve quality of health care services. That would be the status of the law in Oregon if this bill passed. It would be illegal for an insurer to have any payment system that attempted to control or coordinate the use of health care services in order to contain improved quality or reduce cost. State Farm Insurance Company is a mutual company owned by its subscribers. They have a system in place that they believe leads to the payment of what is owed under the policy, and that's how they administer their program. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd simply stop and answer any questions the committee might have.
Go ahead, Sean.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I represent the National Association of Independent Insurers, NAII, which is the Property and Casualty Insurance Trade Association, representing more than 700 member insurance companies. In Oregon, there are about 214 NAII members, companies doing business in the state of Oregon, responsible for about 35% of the personal insurance lines written in the state. NAII is in opposition to Senate Bill 2018. Again, to reference the bill, the definition of managed care is very broad on page one of the bill. It would seriously impede and could eliminate entirely insurer efforts to make sure that care was necessary, that it was appropriate, or even that it would not be detrimental to the policyholder. It would interfere with insurer efforts to challenge unproven or ineffective treatment, and it would also encourage provider fraud and abuse. Again, to reference the bill on page 2, lines 31, essentially when you read that line in conjunction with the definition of managed care, anything that has the effect of containing costs would be illegal under this bill. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I do find it ironic. I know it's this legislature's goal and premise to contain costs in the health care system. It's been prior legislatures' premise to control costs in workers' compensation from the reforms passed in the 90s. And this bill guts that particular premise and essentially opens up the checkbook. The primary beneficiary of this bill is not the local hospital or the family doctor. To the contrary, the primary beneficiary potentially is the unscrupulous provider who seeks to take advantage of the system. And, Mr. Chair, with all due respect to the requesters of the bill, this is a very small percentage of the providers out there. However, it could have a very adverse impact on the cases or the entire system if that system is perceived to lack adequate controls. House Bill 2018 will add unnecessarily to costs. Currently, auto coverage has the fewest tools available to address unnecessary and improper care. You heard this from the prior testimony that there's very few tools out there for us to contain those costs. This bill would take away those few tools and would increase the cost of the care and the premiums for the coverage. House Bill 2018 is not in the policyholder's best interest because it will allow providers to use up the coverage limits on unnecessary and inappropriate care. Using up this coverage improperly essentially lessens the coverage that is available for the policyholder under their existing policy. Mr. Chair, I would just conclude to urge the committee to reject House Bill 2018, and thank you, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
No questions.
Thank you. Gentlemen,
thank you very much. Jack Barnes and Lana Butterfield.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jack Barnes representing Farmers Insurance. We have nothing in addition to add to the opposition testimony that you've heard already, but we did want to go on to the record with our opposition to House Bill 2018.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lana Butterfield, and the witness that I would normally bring to you to talk to you about this bill is in sunny Mexico, and he didn't take me with him. But like Jack, I wanted to come and signal SAFCO's concern about House Bill 2018. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Westlander.
Inquiring minds have to know who is the witness. I mean, we want to know, you know, who to beat up when that individual gets back. Who is in sunny Mexico?
Well, it's my claims analyst who does a wonderful job for me.
Well, it could be a sunny Salem.
My sense is it's a little warmer in Mexico. But thank you very much. I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2018 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2462. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2462 is requiring that all Oregon health plan participants be an Oregon resident, and it establishes additional types of information that may be used as documentation to validate the residency requirements.
Thank you, Sandy. Just for the committee's benefit, we're going to be scheduling a few of these bills specifically to get some information on the record, try to define the various tools that we have as we proceed to remake the healthcare system in Oregon. I'm not necessarily assuming at this point in time that any specific legislation moves forward on its own, but the answers that we get will hopefully become part of the more comprehensive legislation that's going to be written. So, but please ask all the questions that you want to. James, you sure that you don't want Katie to do this for you? Except we do want to talk about this bill and not her book, so it's probably appropriate that it's you.
I know very little about her book, so we'll have to wait for that to come out in print. Good morning, Chairman Cruz and members of the committee. My name is Jim Edge. I'm the Acting Assistant Administrator for the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. And thanks for that clarification on how the bill might be used and the fact that there might be some changes before something finally comes out in final form. Based on a 1999 Legislative Council opinion and our own verification process for the Oregon Health Plan applications, the Department of Human Services at this time is unable to support this bill. House Bill 2462 states that medical assistance shall be available to Oregon residents who are medically needy or categorically needy. It adds a proof of residency provision to the existing application requirements and specifies the documents to be presented as proof. This bill also directs the department to obtain any necessary waivers from federal regulations in order to implement the bill. Similar bills were previously proposed in 1999 and 2001. During the 1999 legislative session, Senator Gordley asked the Legislative Council for an opinion explaining the constitutional restrictions, if any, on requiring persons enrolling in the Oregon Health Plan to provide proof of residency. The Legislative Council described a 1999 court case, and while they did not rule directly on the proof requirements of House Bill 2700, they stated, "We conclude that to the extent that a requirement to show proof of residency impairs a person's ability to travel between states, and to the extent the requirement creates classifications of individuals able to receive aid, we believe such a requirement to be unconstitutional." Legislative Council also stated that a requirement to prove residency creates two classes of individuals independent from actual residency, those residents with and those without proof of residency. Based on that opinion, we believe that a proof requirement like the one in this bill would encounter significant legal objections and would likely not pass constitutional scrutiny. The department currently has processes in place to verify OHP application information. The applicants must document their address in initial and on reapplications by submitting a copy of one document showing a name and address and selecting from a list of documents. The list includes many of the same pieces of documentation listed in House Bill 2462. If the applicants cannot send one of those documents, the instructions currently allow the applicant to submit a written statement stating that he or she is an Oregon resident. This process allows the department to meet current residency requirements. Thank you for your time and attention, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I guess my question is, I mean, clearly, in my opinion, what we have, whether or not a list of requirements would be acceptable is something that would either be waivable or not waivable by CMS. I'm confused as to how the Constitution plays in this. And you're probably the wrong person to ask that question to.
Mr. Chairman, I probably am. I assume that the constitutional language was referring to the Oregon Constitution, but I'm not sure of that, and we would need to find out from legal people on that. The department's position on this, we totally understand the desire to make sure that people applying for and being enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan really are Oregon residents. It's just our conclusion that based on the legal opinion, and also based on CMS federal regulations, which are relatively open-ended on this matter, we feel that they would not approve a more restrictive application process like this.
Okay, I based on LC's opinion here, I'm thinking that maybe we're looking more at U.S. Constitution because the sightings are California and New York and other places. So
I stand corrected.
I don't know. I mean, I'm just looking at the first paragraph of discussion, and it's citing Edwards v. California and other sites like that, which clearly would not be played upon the Oregon Constitution. So I guess that is a question that needs to be answered. Anyway, because we were assuming that we were dealing with waivable options here and not constitutional issues, so maybe we need a more definitive opinion on the legality of this. Representative Westland.
Two questions, Mr. Chair. Jim, in your opinion, do you think the residency requirements currently in statute regarding the Oregon Health Plan can be tightened up and made more definitive?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Westland, I think there is room to do some of that. I think we would need to consult with the federal government on that to see what they would allow. They tend to be fairly vague in what they will allow unless we ask our question in a very specific way. And it would take some time to get a definitive response from them because they don't respond quickly to these sorts of things. But I think we could do that, yes.
Okay, thank you. Second question, Mr. Chair. And then on page 37 of Katie's book, where the azure sky cascades down into the field of daffodils, don't you think that's a little maudlin, you know, in regard to the very machismo, masculine chief protagonist of the book?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Westland, I'm just wondering how you got an advance copy of that book, and I really want one, too.
I think witness is evading my question, Mr. Chair. I mean, I am offended by, you know, his evasiveness.
I mean, especially, I would question that, too, simply because if there's a murder on page one, why are we in a daffodil field on page 36?
But that's my point.
Representative Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Unless the laws change, like for an Agnew license, you have to live in Oregon 6 months in order to get a resident, to be able to be a resident, right? What constitutes a resident now to apply for Oregon health care?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, I can quote the applicable sentence from the federal regulations that make this kind of vague and is the basis on part of what we're discussing here. So state of residence is the state where an individual is living with the intention to remain there permanently or for an indefinite period, or living and which the individual entered with a job commitment or seeking employment. Those are the two sentences that we're talking about here. And there's some other language, really? But those are the two primary sentences.
The feds were really tight on this. Representative Barker.
I've heard the anecdotal stories that somebody comes up here from Georgia to get all their teeth repaired and goes home. And when I walked through the adjustments, I think they were just going through 10-page application for the Oregon Health Plan. It would seem to me that those anecdotal stories might be very minuscule. I don't know if you have any idea about that. I mean, are most people in the Oregon Health Plan, and I hear complaints that they're poor illegal aliens. What's your feeling about, I mean, do you have
Mr. Chairman and Representative Barker, that's our feeling too, is that there are a few anecdotal stories about people who cross state lines to get a richer benefit package in the state of Oregon. Although as Oregon changes its plan and other states change their plans, I think maybe it's going to become less and less desirable to do that. And we haven't seen that that's been a significant problem.
Any other questions, Representative Tomei?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, it's interesting to me on the second page of your testimony when you list the documents that are needed to prove residency, an Oregon identification card, an income tax form, or a note stating they are a resident. It seems that that is given equal weight. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tomei, yes, that phrase is placed in the rules to accommodate those people who have not acquired one of these other official documentations, and it's simply a statement on their part that they do reside here and intend to continue to reside here. And that is a bit of an open-ended area. It's a bit of flexible area, and maybe the specific part of the rule that this bill is intending to tighten up a bit, but it is consistent with the federal regulations as they're currently written.
Thank you, Jim.
And clearly, which is why in the bill it states that whatever we're going to propose has to be waivable, so we're in compliance. But that specifically was what we're looking at. Is, you know, I could write you a note.
Write your own note.
You could write your own note, theoretically. So, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That terminology reminds me of Measure 23, which went down by a humongous margin. It was essentially, I state that I'm here, I'm a resident. My question, Mr. Edge, is something you may or may not be able to answer, but I have a friend whose daughter on minimum wage came down with a very strange syndrome condition. And while in process between Oregon and California, they've now spent almost $800,000. Is your impression that California or Washington or Nevada would accept her and pay her if she just wrote a note, said, I now live in California?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I'm not positive of the answer to that question. My assumption is that all states have rules that conform to the federal regulations, which are very liberal about people declaring their intention to become a resident of a state and that being a basis for their residency.
And I would say that from the perspective of the feds, you know, Medicaid is a national program, and they think it should be portable across state lines, and I have no problem with that per se. But clearly I think there should be some tightening of what's there. And I guess what I would request from OMAP would be, based on your relationship with CMS over the years, if you could get to us what you think might be reasonable as far as tightening up the vagueness of that language so that we can ask the right questions.
Mr. Chairman, we can begin the process of those discussions with them, and we'll do that.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other questions? Thanks, Jim. Scott?
He still didn't answer my question.
About the book? Yeah, I know. Katie is being very tight-lipped about her book. Unless you're a reporter and want to put it in the paper, then she'll talk to anybody. Good morning.
Good morning. Mayor Cruz, members of the committee. My name is Scott Taylor. I'm Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I'm here to basically provide a brief piece of information as we reviewed House Bill 2462, and with that, we have submitted some Dash 1 amendments. Department of Corrections transitions about 3,500 people back to the Oregon communities each year. And these folks have finished their time in the Oregon prison system. They are put on post-prison supervision, and they are returned to the community. We've been studying that for several years. We're a national model on our reentry program, and we've tried to identify the obstacles they face and have tried to eliminate or reduce those that were unintentional. The lack of appropriate identification is often one of those obstacles. Because they were incarcerated, many released offenders do not have a valid Oregon driver's license, identification card, or income tax return. However, they do have an official state-issued Department of Corrections identification card. Hopefully in the handouts you'll see a little example of those. Mm-hmm. So every inmate we have in the institutions now has one of these cards. We believe we know who these folks are and where they came from. And what we would recommend or support is -1 amendments that would insert in the list of the three primary identification pieces a fourth that would be the Oregon Department of Corrections identification card. We do have a number of folks who are released who have mental health issues or severe medical issues. We've been doing a pilot with the Oregon Health Plan for several years, and these folks that we're specifically talking about, any additional obstacle or any reduction in their ability to at least get in the door to have the conversation about whether they qualify results in some additional problems down the road that frequently cost us all a lot of money. So we'd like the opportunity to have this considered.
Yeah, and committee, the department brought this to my attention early on in the session, and I agreed with them. For one thing, somebody being released from prison, we have a high level of certainty they've been a resident of the state for some period of time. But this also speaks to the other issue that we've been trying to transition towards is expediting eligibility once they are released. So the chair is absolutely fine with this amendment. I think it's an important inclusion. So, any questions, Representative Westland?
Mr. Chair, question to you. What is an Oregon Trail card?
Oregon Trail card is basically food stamp card. Not basically, it is the food stamp card.
Okay.
When we went to electronic food stamps. Yeah, Representative Anderson.
Food stamp card that's essentially been tightened down a little bit over the last few years.
Well, actually, the card was the tightening down. One of the theories behind the food stamp card, besides streamlining the administration of the program, was that it would help prevent people from buying things, getting change, and then accumulating change to buy things that they shouldn't buy with food stamps. So it's just like a regular credit card, or debit card, I guess, would be more accurate. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2462, and we are adjourned.